Thank you for being with me today, Jeff Marslet, Lily Gladstone, and John Wei, for the movie Quantum Cowboys. So how much did you all know about animation as a director and as actors before you embarked on a project with 12 different animation techniques?
I mean, I was a bit of a ringer. I taught animation at the University of Texas for 15 years. So I'm basically a self-taught animator, but then I taught other people animation, and I've made maybe about half of my films in my career have been animated. So I did have some experience, but you too?
I've only ever engaged with animation as a consumer before this moment. This is my first time as an actor in an animation, or an animated project, I guess I should say, yeah.
Yeah, same. I did watch a little bit of behind the scenes of things like The Hobbit, like Benedict Cumberbatch and the full green and everything. That was a very different character.
Motion capture. Yeah.
Motion capture, right. So just to kind of break my paradigm of film acting, because I have a theater background, and you always try to withhold the theatricality when you're on film because it's plays too big. But in watching these other actors tackle green screen animation, whatever technique, it was like everybody has that freedom to be a little bit more theatrical. So I knew the scenes when we had the backgrounds, when it was us, I could dial it back into the filmic acting a bit more. But then knowing when we would be fully animated over the top, then it was like, okay, it was almost like mask work.
Liberating.
You just know, yeah, you wear it. It's like thinking of the animation as that a little bit more, so it could be a little more grand. I could be a little bit more exaggerated with some of my facial gestures because I knew that the performance would be breaking through the animation in a way.
Okay.
So I don't know if I necessarily calculated all that, but that was the sense. And just being in the space, the nature of the space, like when you're shooting a film, you kind of absorb the environment. Like, unfortunately, like I think a lot of actors experience this, but your best take is when you don't have all the cameras cluttering your vision and you can just absorb the environment. But then, you know, it changes it. But when you're in a barn with a green screen, it felt like doing black box theater again, where it's your imagination, limited props, and the performance is basically it. So yeah, it was different. It was the first time, but it felt like it was pretty successful.
These actors were incredible, and they really, you know, to watch the finished product, there's a ton of visuals, and it's crazy, and it would be easy to think they were able to do their performances because they were in this wild space, but the truth is these actors had to work in a barn that was, I don't know my Celsius, it's below zero Celsius, but like 10 degrees Fahrenheit, this freezing cold barn with just a green wall and dirt for a floor, and some horses and a few costumes and props. The fact that they could play so immersed in it was a gift to me, and I'm still in awe quite a bit.
They were incredible.
Yeah.
So I understand this project is a trilogy. Was it your intention from the beginning, and how do you approach a producer with such an ambitious project?
Mostly you approach producers and they say no when you have a project like this. So Fit Via V, you know, was the production force behind this, Bill Way, and I couldn't be more thankful. Certainly as an executive producer, there could not be a more supportive and generous head of a company, and especially when you're making something this weird, for them to be so supportive and take such a risk is almost unheard of. So that in itself is a special kind of miracle that this film got made, and that they're still supporting this film is incredible. So that was, I forgot, what was the beginning of the question? I got lost in the phrases of Fit Via V. Oh, it was a trilogy. So when it was initially written, the idea was not necessarily a trilogy. It was maybe a series. It was maybe a movie. Maybe we didn't know what it was. But the trilogy came out of the fact that as I took the ideas that Howe and I wrote in Crazy Person notebooks, which I did for a couple years of writing our crazy ideas down, and then I turned them into, as Howe often says, I turned them into something filmable. But that something was about, you know, 6 hours worth of material. So it was really the fact that what I finally wrote was long enough that I had to figure out, was this a TV series or was this multiple movies? And I basically personally don't have any experience. I know nothing about pitching a TV show, or maybe that's what it would have been. So I turned it into a trilogy.
So did you ever consider choosing only one type of animation, or was it always the plan to mix them all together, maybe to go with the idea of multiple realities and multiple aesthetics?
Absolutely. It was always, even in the script, if you read the script that I wrote, it was marked where I drew a whole map and marked where animations change. If someone was to just fall in love with this movie and buy the DVD, you could take different animation styles and connect just them, and there would be a way to figure out whose memory each animation style represents. So it was always intended to be multiple styles, each of the styles representing a point of view in the film.
So there was one line in the movie that really struck me. It's planning insults the future. You know that would be the line. You wrote that on purpose.
Oh yeah, it's very, and it is a utter truth of the universe.
Yeah, it is very deep, but also almost ironic to hear in an animated movie that is probably, that requires the highest possible level of planning. So.
And it's the highest possible truth. Once again, everything we planned was harder, was different. You know, it's what happens when you plan things out. That's not going to happen. That's the universe. So, Nico Case's character who says that, Esteban's character, you know, who says you can't reinvent anything. Mm-hmm. There's only inventing something new. John Doe telling you can't change the past, kid. Throughout the film, I tried to give all these characters part of their reason for existing in the periphery of the main characters, is to, frankly, make the end of this movie obvious to those characters from the beginning, really telling them ways to navigate an uncertain universe. Hopefully in slightly clever ways, in ways that the characters eventually absorb.
I guess you have to find a middle ground between planning and accepting things as they come. Yeah. So Lily and John, you are both starring in other films in competition here at the Champs-Élysées Film Festival. So congratulations. And they could both be qualified as modern Western movies. How important is it for you to connect to the American territory and its history?
I mean, being Native American, I can't separate myself from it. I was born and raised on my father's reservation, Blackfeet Reservation, around and within a community that has a very different relationship with time and space, I found when I left the reservation. I mean, there's a joke. It's not just an Indian country. It's like, it's in the Black community, it's in a lot of Asian communities, we call it Indian time. And it's the joke is you just show up when you're ready, and people show up when they're ready. But that's also kind of the planning insults the future sort of a thing, because that's oftentimes planning is one person's agenda, you know. And the American Western before the 1930s was a little bit more of an egalitarian thing, because you had people representing their communities making their films, and then people lost interest in that. Like the 1920s, we had a lot of Native American filmmakers making films about their communities, their stories, their ceremonies, whatever, getting avant-garde with it. You had creative, beautiful films. And then World War II happens, the Depression happens, America needs to have this like cowboy mentality, this hero overcoming, and then that became the Wild West. The enemy became the Indian, the hero became the cowboy, and that is very much the continuation of one written history of Manifest Destiny. So doing Westerns for me, I mean, I just naturally kind of get plucked and cast in them, so I'm careful about what my character is saying in the piece of the whole. And Lindy's just so very clearly, it's like, well, you know, opportunity is also the opposite of opportunity. Like, we contend with that in Montana. The governor of Montana said, like, Native Americans have a cultural aversion to success. He's a horrible man. And culturally, when you look at it, it's like, well, maybe it's not a cultural aversion so much as we don't place value on people's worth as human beings based upon their job. You know, it's... So it's in doing Westerns like this and in playing characters like this where, you know, Lindy's flawed, but she's also kind of the glue that holds these folks together. And she operates in a time and space that is a very indigenous way of looking at the world. Gary Farmer's character also delivers a lot of these little pearls. So it's, I don't want to call this a revisionist Western. You might make an argument for that.
We did very intentionally. I mean, revisionist, maybe I agree with you, maybe isn't an exact right word, but there was a conscious effort. I mean, the movie's about memories, and one of my reasons for choosing a Western is that's where I grew up too. That's mm-hmm. the space that I identify with. But also, Westerns have been through exactly what Lily's talking about, through this iconization. I don't know if I'm using the verb right, but making of icons that people like John Wayne and Clint Eastwood, I mean, I enjoy watching those films, but Clint Eastwood was a guy from California in Spain making something that has nothing to do with the reality of the West. It's cool, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. But that exists long enough, and somehow people think that's what the West is, and it isn't and wasn't what the West was.
Right.
And so there was a very intentional thought to revisit at least the Western mm-hmm. and say, hey, you need to look at things from other sides too. And we talked about this the other day, but I think there is a future to science, there's a future to history that's going to be what I would call indigenous thought, that we're going to stop looking for that single cowboy who identifies what things really were and start to realize the value in someone saying, this is what things are. And then I say, no, this is what things are. And John says, no, this is what things are. And we're all right. That there's a way of thinking in which you can accept three possible realities of the same thing. All is correct. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a more indigenous thought than Western thought.
Absolutely. I mean, it's central to oral tradition. Like, we have stories that everybody knows, but every storyteller who inherits the rights to these stories puts their own spin on it, and that can be very confusing for people who want to document it. Mm-hmm. I think there's an anthology of stories from Blackfeet, so it's Blackfeet Tales of Glacier National Park, and the anthropologist was James Willard Schultz. I believe it's that publication, but the preface of one of his books, that's an anthology of Blackfoot stories, was sitting with a Blackfoot man, a storyteller, and saying, I'm not sure what to do here, because I've asked like four or five different people for this story, you know, whatever it is, this particular trickster story, this hero story, and they're all different. So which one's right? Which one do I record? And the man he was speaking to pulled a flower up from the ground and said, this flower is like the story, so everybody knows what this flower is, everybody knows what the story is. But the different versions are like the root system. You need some going in every direction to make the flower stronger. It all enriches it and tells the whole story. It's similar to the round table beach ball analogy, where if we have a beach ball sitting between you and I, I'm going to argue forever that it's red. You may argue forever that it's green, but it's both. It's all of it. So it sounds very simple, but it's quite profound when you apply it in all of these disciplines, including like philosophy of multiverse. It's
because perception is great, because I love the way things taste and smell and look. I mean, that's probably exciting. Perception is also a handicap. It limits our thinking. If you just, from where I came from previous to filmmaking of science, Euclidean versus non-Euclidean geometry, you can mechanically work through the world if it's Cartesian flat plane, but you can also mechanically work through the world if you consider there's nothing flat and everything is a circle. They're just different ways of understanding. Neither's wrong. Both are totally different.
I turn to you, John Way, with a pretty easy question I'm almost ashamed of.
Give it to me. No, I'm happy. give me the slow ball question right there. Let me just...
We were talking about John Wayne and Clint Eastwood and all those legends, and with your name.
Oh, yeah.
How do you identify to these legends, and was it maybe an influence for you to go to Western movies, or is it just a coincidence again?
Well, sometimes a coincidence is the opposite of a coincidence.
Yes.
There you go. No, I actually moved to the States when I was younger, and the first place I moved to was Arizona. So Arizona was like the introduction to an American existence for me. So I always felt an affinity to the West. And not only an affinity to the West, but I feel like to the stories that depict the West in a more accurate way. I've never once seen a shootout there with men with pistols in the street. I think it happens, actually, so unsurprisingly enough. But the West is also full of a lot of kind, a lot of diligent, a lot of thoughtful, loving people. And I think, a love song demonstrates that, and to some degree, Quantum Cowboys does that too. The character Bruno is just not a fighter. You know, he's just... He's a man who just happens to be in the Wild West, but he's not a wild guy. You know,
it's too cold out here.
Yeah. So even in the stick-up scene, the hostage scene, the moral responsibility of having someone's life in your hands was too much. So he puts the blanket, gives the whiskey, goes finds his friend. And I think there were maybe a lot more people like that than than former cinematic experiences would let on. So,
And I think it's worth noting at this point in the interview that from now on he's known as Jean-Jacques Way.
Yeah.
We've renamed him in France. Jean-Jacques.
That's my French existence is now Jean-Jacques.
That's perfect.
John is dead. Jean-Jacques has been born, though.
2 weeks in France and we now have Jean-Jacques.
It changes you.
I like Burgundy wine too much to go back. It's the truth.
I mean, he's already a fixture star in the making. We just need to catch up to that timeline. I mean, people here realize that. We were at a Turkish restaurant yesterday and a whole wait staff came up to him and said, "American actor?" And he's like, "Yes, I am." And they all wanted to take pictures.
I recognize you.
I didn't lie to him. They said, "Are you an actor?" And I went, "Yes." They got the whole restaurant around for a photo. I'm like, "I don't think I am who you think I am."
They're probably thinking of Henry Cavill.
That's exactly what I said. Hey, Henry, if you're listening to this and you need a young Witcher in your next project, I'm your guy. Okay, you pass me.
But Henry, I know this is radio, so you can't see. I'm just warning you. He looks really good, so you're going to bring your A game for this guy.
Hardly.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and I think this is...
They're giving us the hook.
Yeah. So, yeah, thank you, and I wish you all the best for the two following movies.
I wish us the best, too. If you're out there, come see this movie, support it. Let's make more.
Please.
Yay.
Thank you all.
Tell people you really like it.